This is London calling.
You are listening to Thought and Leaders.
Hello, 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 and welcome again to another global podcast that is Thought and Leaders. As you know, I scour this beautiful, amazing, magnificent planet of ours to find the most insightful, the most inspirational, the most intriguing thought leaders out there. And this week I am incredibly lucky because this week I have got Gerald Ashley. Now, he is an advisor, a writer, a speaker. He's a broadcaster on business risk and decision making. His work concentrates on trying to understand risk taking and human behavior in the face of uncertainty. And boy, do we have uncertain times at the moment. Hello, Gerald.
Jonathan, hi.
Great to have you here with us on Thought and Leaders. I wanted to talk to you, Gerald, because we are living in a time of uncertainty. The first thing about uncertainty is about risk and fraud. Today, I had to order a new password for my NatWest card. And while I was on hold, this voice recording came up and said that because there's so much fraud in the last year, that many merchants, they're not ready for the new system that NatWest has that deals with fraud.
Right.
What's happened?
We're in an information war. The reason people are uncertain about something is when they lack information. And so when you have really good information, you may be, as a child, you have a very organized life by your parents. You know, you're going to have breakfast in the morning, you're going to go off to school, and everything's sort of quite organized for you. And so you feel quite certain, so you don't have a problem with it. And I think that's something we carry through our adult life, and we get very nervous when we don't have enough framework or information around us, hence we become uncertain. And there are two things to say about uncertainty. The first one is, and this isn't really a spoiler, but I'm here to tell you there always is uncertainty. There's always uncertainty. People really hate it, and we all want to buy certainty. And if you think about it, let's have a go at being fraudsters. If I or you want to be fraudsters, what we're really trying to do is convince people of something. And the best way to convince people of something is to offer them certainty. It may well be slightly bizarre form of certainty, but if it kind of walks like a duck and sounds like a duck, it must be a duck.
That's true.
Any form of disinformation, if you like, is sort of trying to play on people's fears and offering them a certain answer. I have a little catchphrase. Certainty is the crystal meth of decision making. We always want more certainty.
Right.
We're always questioning one another. So, you know, I would say to you, well, are you certain? Do you know definitely, Jonathan, this is going to happen? Look at company names. Company names, they often have the word solutions in the company name.
Right.
Well, this is great. I love these guys because they're going to offer me a solution. So if you think there's this commodity called certainty, which is slightly an amorphous idea, but we are buyers and sellers of it. We're all definite buyers. And then sometimes it might be in a job interview. I want to convince you I'm the right man for the job. I'm trying to project your need to feel certain about me. I think if we don't feel certain, all sorts of alarm bells ring. The skill of the fraudster is to sound entirely normal, reasonable, comforting in a way, where in fact their proposition may well be anywhere from slightly dodgy to completely you're mad if you get involved in it.
Have we reached a point that nobody trusts anybody anymore?
Yes. I think you're right to talk about trust. I think trust is something that has eroded throughout my lifetime. I think people are much more wary. What we must remember is that we're dealing with far more people than we ever used to. If you jump onto the net or you're on social media, there's a bigger pool of people who may not be 100%. The definition of Twitter is a way of arguing with people you've never met before. And, you know, all these people have all these big Twitter arguments. This didn't exist because there wasn't that big pool of people to talk to or to argue with. It's the same with any form of online fraud. There are more people like us to be targeted, and they only need a small number of people to fall into the trap.
Ah.
The other thing which I think is important about human beings is we do as we're told. We always like to think that, you know, we're free agents and that we kind of, you know, we're sort of walking around a bit like George Clooney, Mr. Confident and all the rest of it. But we are very swayed by legitimate, or what we consider to be legitimate, authority figures. You only have to put a white coat on and a stethoscope and wander into a hospital and everybody thinks you're a doctor.
I want to thank people for their incredible sacrifices and what they've done. Everybody working in the NHS, across social care, everyone involved in the vaccine program, and frankly, everybody in this country who has risen to the challenges that we've seen over this past 18 months. I'm very proud of what we've done to protect the NHS at the peak, to deliver that vaccine rollout, one of the fastest in the world, and I look forward to supporting the government and the Prime Minister from the backbenches to make sure that we can get out of this pandemic, build back better so that this country can fulfill its potential, which is so great. I will do that with all of my heart.
Gerald, for the last, whatever it is, over a year, we have been told that we have to do certain things and we have to make huge sacrifices.
Sure.
But then what happens is that we find that the people who are telling us, the man in the white coat, why should we believe him or her if they are doing things in a double standard way?
Well, I think it's nothing like a double standard to make people very angry.
Well, yeah.
You know, people get angry because in a way we feel we've been fooled. One of the things about being fooled, it's important that you don't notice you have been. That is the other art of the con man, is to, obviously you don't realise you're being done. And so when we think of recent political incidents over the last year or 18 months where people have broken the rules, people feel angry about that. I think they feel they need some form of retribution normally as well. So authority figures, we will obey them quite consistently until we rumble them or we feel they are being inconsistent. And then I think people flip very quickly. We don't get fooled again. Whilst we're on this idea of training to become fraudsters, because I always think it's useful to look at the other side of the equation. So if we're trying to train to be fraudsters, it helps if a person likes us. Now, that's more of a personal thing than necessarily an online thing. Also, we like people who appear to be offering us help. So, you know, these scam phone calls of, I'm ringing up to tell you that I can help you before the Inland Revenue are going to be on your back and all the rest of it. We kind of buy into that. It's all about trying to get this mirage of certainty. The most important thing we can do in life is to get used to being uncertain.
Yeah.
Let go a little bit and to say, look, you know, I just don't know the answer. It feels 60-40 to me, and let's hunt around for information. Information is the disinfectant for uncertainty.
Information is a disinfectant for uncertainty.
Yeah.
Do you mean facts is a disinfectant? There's too much blasted information out there. Stop all this information. It's too much. I can't take it.
Well, this is knowledge versus information. This is the other problem, and we come back to trust, is we need some form of filters. So in the same way as you shouldn't take tax advice from some bloke you've only just met down the pub,
right.
It's why we tend to have a sort of close-knit form of network of people we might discuss things with and say, oh, you know, I'm a bit worried about my car or the garage I bought it from. Those informal networks for gaining more information are a good way of trying to counter the uncertainty. What is fatal is to think there's a get out of jail card where, oh, there's this guy who's got a solution and all my uncertainties will go away. Because we're trying to buy something that doesn't exist.
And you were talking earlier about Twitter.
Yeah.
And also you were talking about the, you know, how people used to get angry because people weren't wearing a mask or whatever they were doing last year. Isn't it a case that people fall into one group where we are now angry about this, and then they fall into another group, which is, no, we're actually angry about that. I mean, it's we're not very stable. We just go from one group to another.
People enjoy being angry when there are no direct consequences. So I have no problem insulting you on Twitter. It'd be a bit different if it was face to face. I find it incredible that anybody takes any notice of Twitter if it's from an anonymous account. It could well be a robot in, you know, China or Russia.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, amongst a few other well, let's throw in North Korea to balance things out a bit.
All right, then.
But I think that you're right about there being far too much information. We need to filter that.
Yeah.
And this is the last part of the equation. We have to use judgment.
Yeah.
What happens with groupthink is judgment goes out the window. Because I don't want to be the guy who puts his hand up and say, I think that's nonsense, when everybody else around the table has nodded, you know, very sagely that it's the thing to do.
Right.
It's very difficult to stick out and put your head up, and or your hand up, rather, and actually say that you disagree with something.
I want to go back to Joseph Goebbels.
Ah.
Die ganze deutsche Nation zur Arbeit.
He said, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it.
Yeah.
The information can become knowledge if you say it enough.
The great ambition, if you want to be a dictator, is to control people's language. Because if you control their language, you start to control the way they think, and it becomes much more easy to control them within whatever sphere or world you may be in. Listeners may recall the novel from the 1930s by Evelyn Waugh called Scoop, about a sort of newspaper baron, and he's a sort of titanically aggressive, very unpleasant man called Lord Copper.
Right.
Everybody's terrified of Lord Copper, and nobody's prepared to say no. And there's a catchphrase in the book, which you may have heard of because it sort of slipped into the English language.
Oh, yeah.
Is it instead of saying no, his staff always used to say, well, up to a point, Lord Copper. And up to a point was the furthest people would dare to say no. You make an interesting point about Goebbels. Goebbels was a marketing genius. He's quite an evil individual, but he was a marketing genius. And they did tap into a German nation in the early 1930s that was terrified of the future. There was no certainty. People's wealth had been destroyed and all the rest of it. And so maybe the big grandstanding projection of a new idea worked in those situations.
When I was growing up, Gerald, the newspapers were very, very different than now, mainly because they were on paper. And it meant that today's news, tomorrow's fish and chips and all that stuff. But today it's very different, okay, because the news is out there one moment, then it's another moment, and it's all in your pocket.
Sure.
Last year, when COVID was really upon us, the press ensured that one side of the story was told, which goes back to what you said, Gerald, which is people got angry when you heard an opposing view, not wearing a mask or whatever it might be. Do you think that the press still has a really big role when it comes to influencing society and working with politicians?
I think their power is less simply because there are other outlets. Even sort of podcasts like this, when they get to a certain level of listeners or readerships of blogs and all the rest of it, can add into the mix. There are a lot of bad actors out there who are just basically pushing a line, however bizarre it may be. But again, I'm going to sound like a broken record here. If I can convince you that I have got a plausible story that's going to solve your problem, you will go for it. I'm not a great believer in conspiracy theories. I think life's more about cock-ups, to be honest.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, could argue that if you were running the government, you might lean on some information channels to sort of play a certain line. Because, you know, you don't want everybody out and about when we were in lockdown and all the rest of it. And so you run a lot of films showing where everybody is behaving themselves. And this is kind of another element, which is we look for social proof. Well, everybody else is doing something, so I should do it as well. So maybe it's a step too far to accuse broadcast media, but they certainly ran a lot of stories about how everybody was trying to cope at home and all the rest of it. As time went on, they changed the story a bit, saying everybody's at home but really fed up. But well done for sticking it out, you know, well done Britain and all the rest of it. What they never do is run stories saying, well, you know, 20% of the people don't give a toss about this, and what are the government going to do about it? So again, you know, social proof is powerful.
Yeah, social proof. Do you think that they had to stop the clapping then at some point because people weren't buying it?
I think that's right. I think you can clap for a little while and then it kind of loses its importance. In fact, it risks becoming counterproductive, I think, at a certain point. You're going to go around and have, you know, clapping marshals saying, people, you should be clapping. I mean, one of the things we seem to have avoided, which would have been very depressing, though there's probably been some of it, is where people have been reporting one another for non-compliance.
Oh, my God. Capos.
Yeah, exactly. You will do as you're told. If you're not doing as you're told, I'm going to report you. One of the, again, depressing things about dictatorial regimes is they rely a lot on Joe Public to report on one another.
Mm. Gerald, if they wouldn't have come up with a vaccination, from the point of view of disinformation or controlling, you know, society, what do you think would have happened?
We would have gone through the winter being increasingly grumpy and annoyed. We'd get to the summer and decide, well, it was all right last summer. And you would have had lots more low-level disobedience. Then you have a problem if you're in government. Do you get all the COVID marshals out?
Yeah.
And start fining everybody on the spot? And at which point does somebody, you know, thump a COVID marshal and then end up going to jail and all the rest of it? It's a complete nightmare for the government. So, I mean, the vaccine is obviously important for us as individuals and as a population, but it's equally very, very important for the government. It allows them to show a way out of this issue. Because otherwise, all you're saying to people is, well, if you think you're uncertain now, it's going to be even worse going forward. My own sense is that people seem to have a certain level of tolerance. Not everybody, but a percentage of people will say, oh, this is nonsense, I'm not going to do it. I don't think we really stretch that, thanks to the vaccine. But if we were here and now and there was no sign of a vaccine, I think people would be more disobedience, too strong a word, isn't it? But I mean, it would fray at the edges in terms of people saying, well, I'm not as bothered as you are. I'm going to take the personal risk. That's quite interesting about the current government message, which is that it's suddenly changed. Look, we all got to grow up now. There's a safety net. That's the certainty of the vaccine. But at the margin,
yeah,
you've got to take your own risk decisions. Maybe your attitude is, well, hell to it. I'd rather die living rather than live dying.
It's a bit of a cop-out, Gerald, isn't it? It's like saying, listen, in the end of the day, you decided to do it. It wasn't my idea. You know, you decided to do it because we're in a democracy. Really?
So are you in the camp that would say that nanny knows best?
No, I'm not in any camp. That's why I'm in journalism. So, they keep on talking about we're going to have every 6 months, every 8 months, every 10 months, another vaccine. I had the AstraZeneca, and I'm telling you, Gerald, I went into absolute shivers and all this stuff, and they're going to tell me to do this every 6 months, 8 months, because they found another variant.
You're saying that the risk-reward calculation for you personally, it's very marginal if you want to go through all that again, because you're pretty relaxed that overall your exposure is pretty limited. A cursory sort of layman's view of viruses, and this is maybe an irresponsible thing to say, the general pattern of viruses is, of course, they mutate. They tend to mutate into weaker forms, but actually more virulent. This may well be why we're getting tens of thousands of cases now. Although the screaming headlines is about shock, horror, this is the new killer mutant version, it turns out not to be, because the vaccines so far seem to have ring-fenced all of this. So I'm optimistic about this, but I do understand people's personal risk preferences can be very different. In fact, that's been, for me personally, the most interesting thing of this whole episode.
Yeah.
How amongst my friends and relatives, they all have very different views on what you should or shouldn't do or what they feel comfortable with. And some of those have been not at all predictable. Some people have been much more risk-taking than I imagined, and also vice versa. The government can do so much, but at the end of the day, we're going to have to make our own personal decisions.
Specialist speakers make your next event
fascinating,
authentic, entertaining,
insightful,
refreshingly honest,
totally compelling.
Contact specialistspeakers.com.
I want to go back to a gentleman who was a stock speculator, Jesse Livermore.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, Wall Street never changes, the pockets change, the suckers change, but Wall Street never changes because human nature never changes.
It's a delightful quote. He's an interesting guy because he lived off the ability to gamble on the stock market. He wasn't a commentator.
Yeah.
He actually had real money on it. In fact, he went bankrupt three times and came back after the first two. And the third time he went bankrupt, he committed suicide. I will give you a new quote to use, which is from the advertising industry, from that very quotable David Ogilvy.
Go on, then.
For listeners who don't know him, he's basically spanned the 20th century. He was born in 1911 and died in 1999 and was absolutely the top man after the war. And he said, in the early 1950s, said, people don't think how they feel, they don't say what they think, and they don't do what they say. So you cannot trust people's opinions.
Yeah.
They think differently from how they feel. Sometimes they're more emotional or irrational.
Absolutely.
They certainly don't tell you what they're really thinking. And they absolutely don't do what they say they're going to do.
100%. Let me pause you there. You're talking about my industry.
Yeah, yeah.
There's been a lot of money made out of companies in market research. You have focus groups. And if you're saying that people don't, well, he's saying that people don't think how they feel and they don't say what they think and they don't do what they say, what's the point of a focus group?
I think focus groups are baloney. Because I tell you what you want to hear. And a really good way of looking at that is exit polls and general polling in elections. In general polling, I stop you in the street and say, you know, are you a Green voter, monster raving loony party, Tory, Labour, whatever? And you say, oh, you know, I'm Lib Dem or whatever. And I tick the Lib Dem box. That's completely irrelevant to how you're actually going to vote. A much better question is to ask people who they think is going to win the election.
Mm.
So if I stop you in the street and say, well, Jonathan, in your constituency here, who do you think is most likely to win?
Right.
You're much more likely to give an accurate answer.
Yeah.
This leads on to the economist John Maynard Keynes.
Keynesian theory, yeah.
Yeah, you can look this one up. It's called the beauty contest. He said, just imagine there's a competition in the evening paper. And I guess he said this in the 1930s. So he said, bathing beauties. We probably should be less sexist these days. But there's a competition.
Okay, fair enough.
We'll stick to the original. And there are, I don't know, 100 girls who are all lined up. You have to answer two questions.
Okay.
Who do you think is the most attractive girl? And so you kind of look through the list and say, well, you know, I really like number 53. So you put 53 down. But the critical question is the second question. Who do you think all the other people who enter this competition think is the most beautiful girl? And then you might say, well, actually, my choice was a redhead, but maybe redheads aren't that popular. So in fact, it's number 23 is going to be the most popular one.
Okay. Got it.
Hold that thought.
I'm holding it.
Look at the individual stocks of the FTSE 100.
All right.
And so instead of 100 bathing beauties, we've got 100 stocks.
Yeah.
So you say to yourself, oh, I think Marks and Spencers look cheap down here. I think, you know, they're the one I fancy. They're the bathing beauty I fancy. And you put money into Marks and Spencers. Completely irrelevant, because all that matters is what the market thinks is the most attractive stock. So you might decide that Marks and Spencers is a great punt, but the market's decided it really loves Shell Oil for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And this is why most investors are really bad at picking stocks, because picking stocks, unless you're very close to the game, is a complete waste of time. What you have to learn to do is to read the market. And this is the same about all opinion polls, focus groups, all the rest of it. You have to cut through to what people think is going to happen, as opposed to what they decide to tell you what you want to hear.
One of my great heroes is Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
He said, your job as a marketing person is to create a need for something they didn't even know that they wanted. But you're saying that you go with what the market feels that they want. But he's saying they don't even know that they want it.
There's the quote, which may actually be a misquote, from Henry Ford, which said that if he had asked all his potential clients what they really wanted, they would have said a faster horse.
Yeah.
People have to be, dare one say, guided towards seeing the benefits of new products. I think particularly in a focus group where it's all been carefully weighted for, you know, tall, short, fat, thin, every shape and type of person you can imagine, is actually not the way to go about things. The other thing about Steve Jobs is really quite a monomaniacal type individual. He had a very strong view and he stuck to it. And of course, we always remember his successes, but we don't remember his absolute total failures quite so much. It's worth bearing in mind that Apple only exist because they were bailed out by Microsoft. He was ousted and then eventually brought back, and then he got on an absolute tear of good products.
Isn't there something that you talk about which has got to do with that, which is the peak end rule, that people will remember the highs or the lows, but they forget everything else?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And a good way of thinking of this is if you go to a pop or rock concert, you know, your favourite group don't play all their hits 20 minutes into the set.
Right.
They always play the really good stuff right at the end, because that's what people want to hear, and you keep them there, and it's what we remember. So we don't remember the rather turgid stuff from the album that everybody hated, but the band like playing, so they insist on playing, you know, six tunes you hate. But we all remember the fantastic hits they played towards the end. We have a vividness bias. Certain things are very vivid in our mind, and it's normally the last piece of an event or a series of events that really sticks in our mind. If you're trying to influence or market to people, you want to go out on a big bang.
Mm.
You want a strong ending to things. You don't want it to be a whimper.
Mm-hmm. You, I know, studied Lustig. And of course, Charles Ponzi created the Ponzi scheme. The great listeners seem to be very good at engaging with people, the con men I'm talking about, and empathizing with people are the late Jeffrey Epsteins of this world. Do you think there'll always be a con man or woman?
Yes, because there's a market for it. Again, for listeners who aren't aware, Victor Lustig, he's well worth looking up. He's the man who sold the Eiffel Tower not once, but twice to unsuspecting investors. And, you know, that is genius in itself.
Yeah.
Charles Ponzi, in very simple terms, was just robbing Peter to pay Paul. A really good example of that was Bernie Madoff.
Of course.
And he offered certainty. What did Bernie Madoff say? He didn't offer stellar returns.
Yeah.
He said, oh, in general, we'll always make between 6 and 7% every year. And anybody who's been involved in fund management, which I have, you cannot be that consistent. That is a Titanic alarm bell. And all he was doing was taking the money off of new investors to ensure that the old investors kept getting their returns.
You have an illustrious career in banking, in fund management.
Yeah.
Clients, they're not stupid. Why is it that people will fall for Ponzi schemes and, as you said, Madoff and people like that? I mean, they're not stupid.
The easiest person to sell to is a salesman. Salesmen know the tricks and they know they're being sold to.
Right.
But they still buy into it.
How interesting.
Why is that? You know, again, the old idea, and one you'd be very familiar with, of a left-hand number.
Oh, that, yeah.
You know, this TV is 499.
Yeah.
Nobody goes round saying 499. That's kind of weird. Well, if you ask me how much the telly was, I'd say, well, it's 500 quid. But there's something subtly different in 499. And so you think, well, that's so transparent. You know, any idiot can see it. But it seems to work. So we are easily influenced.
That's a bit of cognitive dissonance.
Sure.
It's where people are convincing themselves.
Sure.
It's the four number that they're interested in rather than the five number.
Yeah.
So therefore it was worth buying it.
Absolutely. Back to your point, why is it that often very intelligent people seem to get suckered into these schemes? A nice little story that might illustrate this. It's all about self-confidence. We actually think we're sharper than other people. So I'm quite confident I'm sharper than you, and you're definitely confident that you're sharper than me. And there's a great example of this. I may get the university wrong, but I think it's the University of Nottingham. Have done a research project on asking people how good they are as drivers. And when you ask people how good is their drive, you've got to rank yourself. Are you above average or below? Something like 80% of people put themselves in the above average section. Now, we can't all be above average drivers. I mean, it happens to be I'm an absolutely excellent driver, and I'm sure you're not very good. So we have this self-confidence in our system. And experts are very prone to this. I mean, look, I know what I'm talking about. I'm an expert. So, you know, I know all this stuff inside out. So sometimes in your own skill set or domain, you can be fooled, which is surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think it's true.
In the roll of the dice, Gerald, it goes up to six. Number one of that roll of the dice, or why people believe, you talk about authority. That we're more likely to be swayed by a legitimate figure.
The man in a white coat with the stethoscope. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so number two on the dice is commitment and consistency.
What happens here is that I've persuaded you to invest in the Madoff fund, and then you start getting cold feet, or you say, well, I've heard a few things down the pub about this guy. And then I go back to you and say, well, hang on a moment, Jonathan. You said you were going to do this. A bit disappointed if you're not going to remain consistent. And now you feel almost a debt to me that you must satisfy. You mustn't let me down.
Yeah. Which brings me to number three on the dice, which is the liking. So I want you to like me. Is that what that's about?
I think it's about two things, actually. We like to do things that other people are doing.
Yeah.
And we judge people, if they're friends, differently from if we don't know them very well. You know, you seem a pretty decent chap. So if you say pile into Bernie Madoff, that seems a good idea and all your mates are in it. It's a sort of herding, actually, that we're herding into that idea.
Which is number four, social proof, consensus.
Everybody else is doing it. And then there's this great thing, which is FOMO, isn't it? Which is fear of missing out.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody else is in Bitcoin. My neighbours made a bloody fortune, apparently. This isn't true. Apparently.
Apparently.
We must climb on board. We must climb on board.
Look, they're ringing you right now. They want to get on board.
Exactly.
Scarcity is five of the six. which is perceived or real, which is kind of that FOMO that you were talking about, isn't it? We desire things that are rare or dwindling because, you know, oh, we're going to miss out on it.
Yeah, I think that is the interesting thing about Bitcoin. Everybody keeps telling me there are only going to be so many Bitcoins made.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we get the role of market commentators. The Bitcoin market didn't exist until 3 or 4 years ago. The net now is full of experts talking about their expertise and knowledge on this market.
Yeah.
This is absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
They're not experts at all.
Well, okay. Which brings me to the sixth one, which is the need to return a favor. Now, I used to do a lot of advertising for charity. In those days, when people still had direct mail, we used to send out a cheap pen or a pencil for them to complete the form to donate money. The idea behind it was that people felt, well, look, they're giving me something. The least I can do is give them something back. The modern version of that is going back to your likes, but in a different type of a like, that it's on LinkedIn. You say, oh, I like you, so therefore I better like him as well and her as well. It just goes round and round in groupthink, doesn't it?
Reciprocation is kind of very powerful, actually. It's quite instructive to watch the shopping channels, because the shopping channels have lots of things on this.
Oh, yeah.
There's always a scarcity. Have you noticed there's always a clock running saying that, you know, this wonderful suitcase, the offer runs out in 10 minutes' time. You get social validation. Look, 700 of these have already been bought. And you think, well, everybody else is buying them. And then sometimes they have a comment box on the bottom that says, you know, Trevor Blah from so-and-so has said it's the most wonderful suitcase he's ever seen. And the reciprocity comes in the pricing. And you will see this again. Not only is this thing only 100 quid, but you can have free credit and it can be split into four payments. So look, I'm giving you even more on top. People feel engaged by these things. I think a free pen, actually, it's not a bad idea.
Yeah, you like that one?
Yeah, I quite like that.
This goes back to Cialdini, doesn't it? He was one of the first who spoke about reciprocity. It makes me feel in our so sophisticated world, are there really people who can be taken as mugs even now? They say 100 people are buying it and they feel, oh, well, I better buy it then.
Well, they also put in those two powerful words, hurry up.
Ah, yeah, buy now. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to be quick. I mean, again, you're the marketing man, but isn't it true to say that some of the most powerful words in marketing to say is it's new and it's free?
Yours free. Get you in there. Get free in there.
I'm signing up already.
There you go.
You see what's going on here is that we get sucked into the process. So with all of these things, you've got to kind of pull back and say, hang on a minute. Does this guy really own the Eiffel Tower? This doesn't seem to make much sense. And is he in a position to sell it to me? And the deal was that he was trying to sell it to scrap metal merchants who were going to get the contract to pull it down and make a profit out of it. To actually question things. So we come full circle here, Jonathan.
Yeah.
We're back to information. So when you get suckered into something, have you really taken the time to just sort of pause and draw in more information and sort of think before you act?
You know, Gerald, I've got a really special dice. Listen, mate, you know your one's got six sides. Well, mine's got seven. It's a really special one. The seventh number between you and me, but don't tell anyone, it's called conspiracy. And I think that's very 2021. People will question things. They question everything, whether it be on Twitter, whether it be on LinkedIn, wherever it might be. They question everything. And I think the modern con man or woman is going to add that seventh side.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, there's a conspiracy about this.
I think that's bang on. And I think people in general believe conspiracy theories are lazy.
Ah.
And they're lazy because they cannot be bothered.
Yeah.
To question the answer. There may be a gap in knowledge, or a gap in information. Conspiracy theories always fill the gap. And I mean, you go back to medieval times when there were many things were completely inexplicable. People didn't understand about comets in the sky as to what was really going on, or what we now understand that we think is going on. So we invent a story.
Yeah.
There's a supreme being who's sending us a coded message. The last thing about that is people want there to be a reason for everything. People find it very difficult to think that things might be random.
Nice.
But we don't like the idea of things being random because, again, that suggests we're not in control.
Oh, yeah. And that gives you the ability to sell a religion.
Exactly. There is this sort of idea of called the God of the gaps, that God ends up being in the gaps of our knowledge because the only way to explain it, it must be God. In fact, we still use the phrase act of God. Well, actually, it's chance. And the key thing to remember about chance is chance has no memory. Mm. So it is just a chance. It's not something that you can necessarily repeat. It's just happened. And people really hate the idea of chance and things just happening. Give me the answer. What the hell's going on? You know, and if you don't know the answer, let's invent one that sounds plausible.
You sound incredibly plausible to me.
It's worked.
It's worked, hasn't it? Or is that my cognitive laziness? I don't know. It's been a serious, serious privilege to have you on the show, Gerald. I've had so much fun doing this. People can get hold of you through specialistspeakers.com, can't they?
Yes, they can.
It's so wonderful to speak to someone who makes you think. We need more of that, Gerald.
I would just say that flattery gets you everywhere, so that's very helpful. As my parting shot, I would just say to people, think. In fact, that was the one word mantra at IBM back in the 1950s, was the word think. You know, think before you act, and just be aware that we're all a little bit fragile and not as smart as we think we are. And there's never a rush to do anything. If somebody's rushing you, unless the building's on fire, stop and think.
What fantastic words of wisdom. Once again, you can get hold of Gerald Ashley by going to geraldashley.com. That's geraldashley.com if you want to book him for your next event. This is the sort of man I think that we need to take us to a different direction in terms of how to think, how to react, how to respond.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Fantastic. And to everyone out there, speak to you soon. Trust.
Thought and Leaders is a Goodbye production. It is heard around the world, but we can't continue broadcasting without your support. If you are interested in sponsoring the show or are looking for award-winning content, including strategy and coaching, please DM us or email reinvent@me.com. That's reinvent@me.com.